On this week's 51%, we recognize National Breastfeeding Month and sit down with author Leslie Lair to discuss her book, A Boob's Life, How America's Obsession Shaped Me and You.
If we could just accept that we all look different, I honestly think it will then translate to how men look at us too and not judge us by our bodies. And that will hopefully have this effect also on laws like family leave and childcare, and we won't be just bound by what our bodies do.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. The month of August is National Breastfeeding Month, according to the U.S. Breastfeeding Committee. The designation is meant to increase awareness of the benefits of breastfeeding and the infrastructure needed to support new moms and lactating parents. Because even though breastfeeding is a natural part of life, many women still face their fair share of pushback for breastfeeding their child or pumping at work or in public. Earlier this month, the state of Connecticut held its own ceremony to spread the word. With Governor Ned Lamont out of state, Lieutenant Governor Susan Bisewitz, a fellow Democrat, signed a proclamation recognizing the month of August as National Breastfeeding Month in Connecticut. Bisewitz says the state has a long history of supporting nursing moms.
The bottom line is that breastfeeding is good for business in Connecticut, and making workplace breastfeeding friendly is very easy. Governor Lamont and I and members of our administration want the people of Connecticut to know that supporting working parents is a priority for us.
Bisewitz says the benefits of breastfeeding are numerous. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, infants that are exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months are less likely to develop certain conditions and diseases like asthma, type 2 diabetes, malnutrition, obesity, even ear infections, and more. Moms, meanwhile, might have an easier time dropping their baby weight and lower their risk of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, type 2 diabetes, and high blood pressure. After that six-month mark, the World Health Organization and the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends you continue breastfeeding while introducing your child to appropriate foods until they are 2 years old or older. Despite this, the CDC says only 1 in 4 babies are getting exclusively breast milk for the first 6 months. State Department of Public Health Commissioner Manisha Jatani says sometimes people can't physically breastfeed for that long. Jatani herself was only able to breastfeed her 2 children for about 6 weeks due to health concerns. Plus, that stigma we mentioned earlier can play a role. Women might not be comfortable or receive pushback when breastfeeding in public. It's difficult to cover up, and lactation rooms that aren't bathrooms can be few and far between. So even with more awareness, breastfeeding is not without its challenges right now. Jatani says her goal is to encourage women to do it as long as they can, with no judgment attached.
It doesn't have to be all or none.
In turn, Bisewitz used the occasion to remind parents of their rights and resources. Under existing regulations set by the Fair Labor Standards Act, employers are required to give lactating employees a reasonable break time in private space, that's not a bathroom, to express breast milk whenever they need to, for a year after their child's birth. Late last year, the federal government passed the Pump for Nursing Mothers Act, expanding those protections to more employees. Here's Donald Epifano, director of the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division.
And these include teachers, live-in domestic home care workers, salaried managers that were exempt from overtime, truck drivers, and farm workers. The Department of Labor is tasked with enforcing the PUMP Act and advising employees and employers on their rights and responsibilities. Any employer who violates the PUMP Act could be required to fix the issue by creating a space to pump. Depending on the nature of the violation, remedies may include reinstatement of the employee, granting of a promotion that was denied, payment of lost wages, and an additional amount of liquidated damages.
Epifano says the PUMP Act also protects employees from retaliation from their employers. Finally, Jatani says it's important to remember that breastfeeding is not something that always comes naturally. It's a learned skill that sometimes takes getting used to. She says Connecticut's Women, Infants, and Children Program, or WIC, has several centers across the state that offer lactation counselors, classes, support groups, and even breast pumps for moms in need. And if it turns out breastfeeding isn't for you long-term or at all, that's okay. Jatani wants parents to be gentle with themselves.
What I want people to realize is that we do have resources to be able to help families and parents through this journey, no matter where your journey takes you. And there is no better bond that a parent can have with their child in terms of watching your child grow from your feeding of them.
For a full list of Connecticut's WIC programs and locations, go to connecticut.wicresources.org. As Commissioner Gittani mentioned, the fact that our breasts can literally sustain the life of a child and provide it with all the nutrients it needs, that is amazing. Of course, that little tidbit is not the only thing that comes to mind when we think or talk about our breasts. More often than not, the conversation jumps to things like breast cancer, Victoria's Secret, or sex. Although, just to point out, breasts are not sexual organs. Our main guest today is author Leslie Lair, who recently put out a new edition of her latest book, A Boob's Life: How America's Obsession Shaped Me and You. Spawned by a lifetime of frustrations with her own breasts, from believing they weren't big enough to worrying they weren't pretty enough after years of breastfeeding and battling breast cancer, Lair set out to research how our culture became so obsessed with boobs beyond their intended purpose, and what that means for women and girls. Now, it might go without saying, but I just want to note that Lair is pretty candid on this subject. While not sexually explicit, she does discuss how breasts are often sexualized in popular media. The word boobs, as you can imagine, comes up a lot, and if that's going to make you blush at all or the even slightest bit uncomfortable, check back in with us in about 13 minutes. But here's Leslie Lair on A Boob's Life.
I had no intention of writing a book about boobs. Had you asked me 5 years ago if I wanted the New York Times to call me a boob expert, I would say no. So it's very odd, but one night I got out of the shower and my husband and I had just moved to a condo. I had been through breast cancer and he had promised me that he'd get me an ocean view because I'm from Ohio and that was like my dream in California. And he succeeded. It was our first night in this condo. It was very exciting. And I got out of the shower. My hair was growing back from chemo. I was feeling all of it. I was feeling great. And I looked in the mirror and I noticed that my boobs were not quite right. They just weren't right. And I was so upset. I just thought, I'm back. And then I realized my whole life wanting boobs. And then, you know, like the Judy Blume movie, the first scene is getting a bra, right? It's like you want boobs to be like your mom. And then you get boobs and then you hide them to get a job and you show them to get a guy. And then you have babies and you feed them and then they get really droopy. And then maybe you get breast implants and then they try to kill you. So I figured my whole life and even all the stuff I'd been through with breast cancer, why couldn't they look good? And I was so wanted to call my doctor and fix them. And then I thought, but you know, are they broken? And my husband said I was obsessed because he just wanted date night. He was like, boobs are like pizza. They're all great. You know, I love you, blah, blah, blah. But I couldn't let go of it. And so we started watching TV for a few minutes and this comedian told a boob joke. And I thought, okay, I am not the only one who's obsessed. This is not my fault. I went in the other room and started Googling around and I realized there was nothing that talked about how women's lives really follow this trajectory of how our boobs are. And I looked up breasts and it was breast cancer and chicken recipes. And I looked up boobs and it was all porn. And I thought, okay, something's wrong here, you know? And I found this picture from when I was a tiny girl, just on the top of my moving boxes. And my sister and I had these matching red bikinis. And it makes me laugh all the time because she couldn't keep the fabric over her nipple. And I realized, oh my gosh, if I knew at 3 years old that nipples were something was weird about them, that breasts were taboo, it's definitely bigger. And so I just started looking into history and I knew that was my next book.
Now, this book operates as both a series of personal essays and as a collection of research and cultural analysis, too. So it's got a bit of a duality there. Let's talk a little bit about the history first and how we got to where we are today, because you make it a point early on to say that, you know, America's obsession with boobs was not always like this. When did it all start?
You're so asking a really interesting question because it wasn't. I mean, boobs were clearly made for babies, right? And I found the science fact that says that men will scan a woman's body in 200 milliseconds to see her chest. And that's like this biological attraction to estrogen to see if they can feed your kids, right? They can't see the butt or any the reproductive organs. That's the gender identifying thing. And so like people who are trans, the first thing they take off, they put on, you don't want to be identified, or you do as females. But it doesn't mean that men have to keep looking. And yet, ironically, when I was a little girl is right when at the peak of advertising, and Playboy had just started, and suddenly there was color TVs everywhere. And the advertisers co-opted the men's eyeballs to sell ads. And then baby formula, like my mom never nursed because science was better, you know? And so boobs stopped being so much for babies and started being much more sexual. And it's so funny because I don't know if you saw the new Janelle Monáe video, Lipstick Lovers. It's like, it's so sexy and there's a whole lot of rear ends. But every time they show the breast, they blur the nipple because nipples are supposed to be sacred for babies. So if you see them in a sexual way, it's really taboo. And so I felt like women, if we've been split between exactly what you're saying, the sexy versus the sacred thing.
You know, it's funny how we pass all these ideas down to our kids too. I mean, you lay it all out in the book about how there's this whole industry around training bras now and bras for preteens. I remember my mom taking me out shopping when I was 11 or 12, and it wasn't really until I think I read your book that I started thinking about it and was like, what was I training for exactly? It wasn't even a real bra. It just seems like a very weird concept to me. And you're right, it starts at a really early age.
It's so funny because then once you need a bra, you don't want to wear one. It's like COVID. I'm barely out of a sports bra now. Today I wore one special to wear a dress, but you know, bras are not comfortable and suddenly we're in it. And I did learn this really fun fact that, well, maybe not so fun, that funeral homes put bras on dead women because that's proper supposedly. So, you know, if you don't want to go into the hereafter wearing a bra, let somebody know.
You've got lists in this book on everything from like the history of Victoria's Secret to popular nicknames for boobs and the history of boobs and cheerleading even. Was there anything that particularly surprised you when putting this book together?
Oh, yeah. I could not believe that there were 150 nicknames for boobs that just I thought of. And most of them were like food. But then also something I didn't know, and you'd think you'd learn this in science class, is that humans are the only mammals that have developed breasts long after childbearing. And so that's some sort of like Darwinist thing, right? Somebody liked boobs and so now we all have them. But you know, your dogs, your cats, they don't have breasts after that at all. And then also I found this other fact that in 1982, the Association of Plastic Surgeons got the FDA to make a guideline saying that small breasts were a disease that led to like an unsatisfied lifestyle for women. You know, and all that did was open up, again, it's about money, things for plastic surgery. And then all the celebrities who are in Playboy, you would not believe. It's just crazy. So it was all kinds of facts like that, that were like, whoa, men really decided a lot of things about women's breasts.
I want to ask a little more about your personal experience now. There's a lot of different ways in which we are forced to use or contend with our boobs. I mean, as you said, we'll sometimes cover them up in certain situations. Other times we won't. We're all using them, I guess, from time to time to get what we want. How did you contend with that in your own life? And I guess still feel like a feminist in the process. Like, how did you come to terms with that?
Well, every day we have to decide what we're going to do with our breasts, right? Are we going to wear, you know, a sports bra or wear a bra that hides them, you know, or a bra that pushes them up? And, you know, and people do use sex to get things, but it's interesting because, you know, and then there's fashion magazines that say breasts are in or breasts are out, which is ridiculous because they're part of our body. But I think it's kind of hard for women because we want to be beautiful, you know, and breasts are part of this womanly package. We can't fight biology. We do need, you know, breasts feed our babies, but then they can also kill us. So every day, our identity really has a lot to do with our breasts. And in fact, the new Sports Illustrated magazine, the swimsuit edition, there's a lot of press now about Martha Stewart being on the cover. And she's showing some cleavage, you know, at 81. It's like it is part of our identity. And so it puts us in this weird double bind because we don't want to, you know, exploit ourselves. And if we show our breasts, is it being powerful because we're proud of our bodies, or is it being exploitation? Like, you know, girls go wild and really whoever's looking is going to look for whatever they want to do. So I think we just need to be conscious of it. But really, I feel like if we could stop judging ourselves by how our breasts look, like if I had looked in the mirror. Well, getting back to what you're saying about our mothers, like my mom thought once I was totally flat chested and gross looking, gross according to the culture, you know, after nursing my two daughters, she thought that I got a divorce and that I'd be lonely because men like breasts. And so she really had encouraged me to get the breast implants. And I just fought it for many years. And then finally on a moment of weakness, I did. And the weirdest thing is I actually did feel more confident. And I wish I didn't, and I don't encourage anyone to do it, but it's ironic that the number of people who get breast implants, breast augmentation is the most popular elective surgery for women in the United States. And it's the same as breast cancer reconstruction, which is really common. And sometimes we don't even get a choice or know that we could just go flat. And generally, depending on how old you are, you make those decisions. But most women do get reconstruction because we have to survive in this culture. We want to be beautiful. And yet, if only we could, I feel like if we would judge ourselves less harshly, we would also judge other women less harshly. Like I grew up thinking, oh, women with big boobs, like that was a big deal. I didn't want big boobs because then I'd be loose or I'd be stupid looking, you know, and could be flat. I could be an intellectual, you know, which boded more for my feminist kind of side. But if we could just accept that we all look different, I honestly think it will then translate to how men look at us too, and not judge us by our bodies. And that will hopefully have this effect also on laws like family leave and childcare, and we won't be just bound by what our bodies do.
I was going to ask, because you do dedicate a whole chapter in your book to your decision to get breast augmentation surgery. You just said you wouldn't necessarily recommend it. Why was that conflicting to you?
Well, meaning is the reason I actually wrote the book, the big question was my boobs were clearly crooked. And after I had had so many surgeries during breast cancer, I didn't actually need a full reconstruction because I never had them all taken off because of the kind of cancer I had. Could have come back anywhere. So I had a lot of operations, and then I did replace my implants, and then I had, you know, chemo and radiation and all the side effects that follow forever, you know, and all the meds and everything. But I thought that night, I thought, oh, I want to call my doctor and just do one more surgery and fix it, because radiated skin is different. So even with the implants, it was completely different. And the real question was, do I really want to do that? Do I want to go through that surgery again? How important is it for my breast to be perfect? And then it turned out to be this other journey that was about far more than, did I want my breasts to look perfect? And ultimately, I took my daughters to Paris instead with that money I had saved. So I did it, but the book turned into this much bigger kind of manifesto of, oh my gosh, I didn't understand all the laws that were affected. And so I didn't like fix them, but I don't regret when I got breast implants. I know the risks, and it really didn't make me feel more confident as a woman. And, you know, I think that we have to live here, so we do whatever we need to do. But when I wrote the book, it became such a manifesto for, you know, it was perfect timing for Time's Up and Me Too and all that kind of stuff happened. And then one reason I'm really excited about the paperback, and there's this whole new chapter and new facts and stuff, was that clearly since then there's been this whole backlash, right? And I was invited to, this is funny because when I was a little girl, I grew up in Ohio and we had 4th of July parades. There was always the beauty queen, Miss Arlington. You know, I never had the figure to do that, right? To be a beauty queen, but I would just watch them. But I knew, you know, I was going to be smart and not pretty. And nowadays you have to be smart and pretty. But I was invited back for my paperback after the end of COVID. My hardback came out during COVID, and I was an honored alumni, probably because ironically the same day, the same week, this book was number one bestseller in feminist literature. It also got picked up as a comedy series by HBO Max. So it has both sides of it. So they invited me back to be honored and to ride in the parade, right? And it was so funny because on one hand, I never had the boobs to be a beauty queen and ride in the parade, but writing about boobs got me in the parade, you know? And then I went back, but it was 10 days right when I was trying to decide how many bras I need for a 3-day weekend, you know, with all the different outfits I was wearing and far too many for a carry-on. It was 10 days after Roe v. Wade was knocked down. And so there I was going back to a red state and staying with my Republican dad. And clearly I'm very liberal and the book is very liberal and forward moving. And it was like my whole world was crushed. I couldn't believe all the progress we had made. And then we were back to before what my mom had fought for. And so it was a really interesting trip.
Well, Leslie, thanks so much for taking the time. What do you hope readers most take away from this book?
That's such a good question. It's so tricky because we are so affected by our culture and what we see on our phones. And, you know, there's this whole thing about body positivity. And yet I realize that's the things that I follow. And so many things are airbrushed and women still are competing for boys. That's biological, you know, and we want to look pretty. And yet we need to be smart and succeed and not be judged. And so I think what I really want to do is I want people to be aware of how, first of all, how important it is to vote for things for women, because we need to have all these choices. We're 33rd in the list of countries for family leave and you know, law, childcare, and things that other places take normally. And so we're still doing it all. And I know as you grow up and have families and all your relatives, for me, I just feel like if we could stop judging ourselves so harshly and know that we have so much more to offer and stop judging our people. I mean, essentially, I want people to vote for women and I want you to love your boobs. And so that's kind of my message. You know, we are all in this together. And if we all were treated more equally, no matter what our bodies look for, it's going to be better for men and women and children in all of America.
Leslie Lehr is the author of A Boob's Life, How America's Obsession Shaped Me and You, out now through Pegasus Books. You can find it at most major booksellers, and a TV series based on the book is now in development with actress Salma Hayek at HBO Max. To learn more about Leslie, you can check out her website. That's leslielehr.com. As you heard, breast cancer was a big part of Leslie Lehr's story, and it's a story that more and more women can relate to. According to the American Cancer Society, breast cancer is the most common cancer in women in the U.S., 30% of all new female cancers each year. And in recent years, the ACS says the incidence rate for breast cancer has inched up at an annual rate of about 0.5%. Now, the average American woman's risk of developing breast cancer stands at 1 in 8. But treatments and methods for early detection are also on the rise. And earlier this month, the Del Mar, New York-based breast cancer organization To Life held a webinar designed to help women, quote, beat the odds. Dr. Padma Sheila Rajagopal, a physician scientist with the Data Science Laboratory of the Center for Cancer Research at the National Cancer Institute, ferried questions on everything from genetic testing to therapeutic options. There are a lot of factors that can play into your risk for breast cancer. First and foremost, your age. The ACS recommends most women start getting regular annual mammograms at age 40. But there are also factors that you can manage, like your weight, your activity level, your alcohol intake, your hormone intake, and if/when you have your first full-term pregnancy. Rajagopal says one of your largest risk factors, however, is already set in stone. It's in your family history. One way to see if there's risk in your genes is genetic testing, and that's where Rajagopal comes in.
When we think about genetic testing in the context of cancer, we're really talking about two specific types. And I will really focus more on one of these types for the purpose of this talk, but we'll go through these in a bit of detail so you have some context for when we use these and why. From the germline standpoint, this is one type of testing you'll hear about. It's also often referred to as inherited testing or syndrome testing. We're looking for DNA that's typically found in all of the cells in your body. This is the stuff you were born with. And this is the stuff that tends to run in families. So we see patterns of cancer that are associated in families related to this type of testing that we're looking for. On the other side is sort of somatic testing, tumor testing, acquired variation testing. Here, we're just looking specifically at the tumor in particular, and this is found only in the person in whom we are who's actually affected by the disease.
Rajagopal says germline testing is the main type of testing used to ascertain a patient's genetic risk for cancer, and it typically involves either a blood sample or saliva. A germline test report can even be used, she notes, to recommend a specific approach or treatment. If you're found to have a positive genetic variation indicating a risk for a specific cancer, for breast cancer, the most common mutations are in the BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes. If you have that, you can start taking note of potential treatment plans and work to mitigate the factors you can control, like your diet and exercise. If you get all negative results, that's good news. And if the test finds a genetic variant of uncertain significance, Roger Kapal says doctors will often lean towards monitoring. It could be a completely harmless mutation in the end. Somatic, or tumor testing, on the other hand, is meant to test a confined set of cells or tissue, like a tumor, and it deals with spontaneous mutations rather than inherited ones. Raj Kapal says it's often used during the later stages of cancer to help doctors recommend treatments. It's not for predicting risk, per se, but for getting a game plan together.
And oftentimes this may be repeated as breast cancers evolve in response to treatment. They will change what mutations are present, and that changes what treatment options may be available.
So how do you know if you should get genetic testing? Roger Kapal says it comes down to a variety of factors, the most obvious being, again, that family history.
In general, we are talking about first-degree family members. So this is parents, siblings, sons and daughters, can extend to second-degree relatives, so aunts, uncles, grandparents, grandchildren. But in general, we're talking about that first-degree family space when we're talking about family history.
But she also recommends germline testing for some patients who have already been diagnosed with breast cancer and gone through somatic tests, particularly if they were diagnosed before age 50 or if they've had multiple types of cancer. That way you can pass along that information to your family members so they can get ahead of the game.
To touch on a couple points that I think a lot of people are curious about or ask about, folks who were diagnosed with breast cancer between the ages of 50 and 60, it's more of a nuanced discussion. The benefit of genetic testing is sort of germline genetic testing is sort of less obviously clear. And so this is just sort of highlighting the NCCN guidelines. There are other guidelines, but they're kind of just saying, if you have some intermittent risk factors, things like on these model assessments, you have sort of intermediate risk, there are intermediate risk assessments in the family, you can consider thinking about testing in sort of that 50 to 60 age range. For folks who were over 60 when they were diagnosed with breast cancer and don't really have a strong family history, the likelihood that we will find a pathogenic germline variant is not high, not one that's related to breast cancer. And so that's also important to keep in mind when trying to think about who would most benefit from this type of testing.
Raj Kapal went a lot more in depth in her presentation about the specific ways to interpret a germline test report and to decide which kind of testing is right for you. To watch the full Beat the Odds webinar and learn more about TLIFE and its programs, you can check out their website. That's TLIFE.org. Thanks for joining us for this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at WAMC.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool, so...